Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Here we are, the last week of the year, and have we got somewhat of a morbid show for you today? I apologize, but that's what's going on in the news. First, they have unsealed the will for Maggie Murdoch, you know, the now deceased wife of Alex Murdoch. The death of Valentin Orwellian Peralta. Unforeseen accident or criminal liability for the police officer. In today's world, let me know. Denver man says, hold my beer when it comes to violence. Delta Karen. What can you say about this once you see the video? Is the judge in the Ghislaine Maxwell matter saying, hurry it up to the jury? And if we had a creeper of the day segment, this guy would be the contender, if not winner, for the creeper of the year. Another random act of violence. It just is ridiculous. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. It is December 28th, 2021. Now, obviously, the holiday is coming up, and so we're going to have some best of videos in the coming days, but it is worth watching, so please do so. Now, if you haven't done so already, you know the drill. Hit the like button, hit the subscribe if you haven't done so already, and as always, leave me a comment below. All right, first on the docket, the will for Maggie Murdoch has been unsealed. Maggie is the now deceased former wife of disgraced attorney Alex Murdoch, who was shot and killed alongside their son, Paul, back in June at the family's hunting lodge. Now, Alex Murdoch found the pair on their property and called 911 immediately. Now, Maggie's will was written back in 2005 and leaves all of her property to her husband. Not surprising, right? That's what people do when they're married. But it's a little unclear how much she actually owned individually, but it appears that it did include the 1,770-acre hunting property where she was killed. Now, Alex Murdoch owned the property since 2013 and then transferred it to his wife back in 2016, according to property records. So they were moving some property around, maybe to avoid some creditors. Who knows? Maybe it was all a big plan. But, you know, when people are in desperate financial straits, they do crazy, desperate things. Now, one strange aspect of the will is that it listed Maggie's sister, Marion Proctor, as the person who would handle her estate. But Marion's name was crossed out in pen, and over it was put Randolph Murdoch III, Maggie's father-in-law. As you may recall, Randolph died battling a long-time illness just 3 days after Maggie was murdered. And Marion Proctor said she was unaware that she was even mentioned in the will until the beginning of this month. And on December 13th, she renounced her right to handle the estate and allowed John Marvin Murdoch, Maggie's brother-in-law, to deal with the handling of the estate. Now, what is significant here is that if there is some property that was not owned by Alex Murdoch, whether it was previously put in her name alone for estate planning purposes or judgment avoidance issues, well, any property, if he didn't already have a possessory interest in it, would then go to Alex Murdoch, and it would be there for creditors to take advantage of and try to attach and use it to settle any judgments, both out of the civil and criminal cases. So we're going to have to follow that for sure. The case, I'm telling you, this is the one case I think the plot is going to twist more and more as people dig deeper and deeper into Alex Murdoch's situation. And as well, there's also information, according to Alex Murdoch's own attorney, that he is a person of interest as it relates as the death of Maggie and Paul. We'll see how that develops. But somehow, I think there's going to be something after the first of the year. Why, you say? Well, although this is the last week of the year, it's been really busy where a lot of people have been getting charged. Why, do you say? It's the end of the year. Everybody's getting those case filings wrapped up because they want to be organized when it comes to the new year. All right, next on the docket, let's talk about this terrible situation regarding Valentina Orellano Peralta. Now, she was shopping for a quinceañera dress with her mother at a Burlington coat factory in L.A. when she was hit in the chest by a stray bullet from a police officer who had fired his gun at a thief robbing the store, killing the young lady instantly. The 14-year-old girl was hiding in a dressing room during the robbery in a crime-ravaged city of L.A. when she got caught in the crossfires. Peralta's parents, both Chilean, are scheduled to hold a press conference today demanding that the Los Angeles Police Department be transparent in their investigation. Now, in surveillance footage from the store, 11 armed officers are seen entering the store in response to a 911 call reporting the suspect, Danielle Elena Lopez, 24, who attacked four women. Elena Lopez was beating a bleeding woman with a heavy metal bike lock when the police arrived. The officer who shot the fatal bullet can be heard on body cam footage yelling, "Victim down." One officer fired his rifle three times, and Elena Lopez falls to the ground as another officer tends to the injured victim. The video footage does not show the victim. Now, behind the suspect, Valentina and her mother were hiding in a dressing room. Police say the officer who fired the fatal shot did not know Valentina was inside the dressing room behind the wall because it looked like just a regular drywall wall. LAPD Assistant Chief Dominic Choi said officers later found the teen's lifeless body inside the changing room. The officer's been placed on a paid administrative leave for at least 2 weeks, and the incident is under investigation, although it could take up to a year. Now, surveillance footage from various locations around the store shows the assailant attacking multiple shoppers, smashing computer monitors, throwing a woman down on an escalator in an attempt to steal her purse. 911 calls were released from the employees reporting a hostile customer in their store attacking customers who was walking around the store looking for people and breaking things. The employees can be heard on the 911 call running around the store frantically telling people to evacuate the store. Employees have barricaded themselves in the office store. The shooting is being investigated by the California Department of Justice under Attorney General Rob Bonta. The Civilian Board of Police Commissioners will eventually evaluate whether officers' tactics, drawings, and exhibits a weapon and his use of deadly force was justified. Now, this shooting comes as homicide rates have soared 52% in the past 2 years in Los Angeles County, and District Attorney George Gascon is under fire for soft-on-crime policies. Gascon continued to be called out for his zero-bail policy that some critics say is exacerbating the region's crime problem by freeing criminals to offend safe in the knowledge that they will be straight back on the streets afterwards. So this raises an interesting issue. Now, obviously, the police officer had no intent to hit a innocent victim in a changing room that he did not know was there. However, I'm sure some people will say, well, that was reckless behavior on the part of the police officer because he knew that those bullets could go through a drywall wall, and therefore he never should have fired the gun. That would be reckless, if not negligent, behavior. I think it was an unintended consequence of killing the bad guy. But the reality of it is, somebody will want the police officer prosecuted. We'll see what the district attorney does out there. Is he going to stand by the police, or is he going to stand by what will soon be a lot of people upset that the police officer took the shot and an innocent bystander was in fact killed? Is it reckless to fire your firearm inside? I don't know. Let me know in the comments. I think the police officer should get a pass on this one. Let me know if you think I'm wrong. Well, while things are going on in LA, guess what? Denver said, hold my beer. Five people were killed and three were wounded in killing a police officer shot in the back during a shooting spree by a gunman that spread from Denver into some suburbs on Monday night. Now, the suspect, described by witnesses as a tall blonde man wearing a trench coat, was fatally shot after he opened fire at officers and struck one in the back. Police say the cop was in surgery overnight and apparently is recovering. Now, the motives of the killing has not been disclosed yet by investigators, and that investigation is ongoing. The shooting spree began about 5 p.m. in Denver near the intersection of East 1st Avenue and Broadway. Those aren't familiar with downtown. That's basically downtown by the Capitol. Police say the suspect killed two women and injured one man before fleeing the scene. And shortly after, the suspects fatally shot another man in a neighborhood park near 12th and William Street. And the suspect fired a shot at 6th Avenue at Cherokee Street, as well as 8th Avenue in Zuni. Police said no injuries were reported at either location. The suspect was then spotted in his vehicle by police near 8th Avenue in Zuni. Officers attempted to pull him over, and then the suspect began opening fire, prompting the police officers to shoot back. The suspect was then reported in the suburb just before 6 p.m., firing shots and killing one more person at an intersection of Colfax and Kipling. Now, soon after, Lakewood officers spotted the vehicle in the Belmar area. Gunfire was exchanged after the gunman shot at police. He then ran away into a nearby business where he brandished his weapon before entering the Hyatt House Hotel, where he shot another clerk. The suspect fled the Hyatt and began shooting at officers, injuring one who then shot back. The gunman was finally shot and killed at that particular location, and it is not clear if he was shot by the police officers or not. Now, Denver reported 6,715 cases of violent crime in 2021. That was as of October of this year. The incident includes 95 murders, 1,038 sex offenses, 4,365 cases of aggravated assaults, and 1,217 robberies. Now, this is a bizarre case because this sounds like something out of a movie, and there's no real motive as to what this person was doing other than really going around doing terrible things to people. And we'll probably never know exactly why because, well, the bad guy is now dead. All right, remember Delta Karen? We brought you the story yesterday. Well, now there is video. Wait till you see this. Like I said, we brought you the story yesterday of a woman who was arrested for assaulting an 80-year-old man who was also a passenger on a Delta flight, and she was upset because he wasn't wearing a mask, even though she wasn't wearing a mask either. Now, the violent passenger is 51-year-old Patricia Cornwall. And guess this, she was a former cheerleader for the Los Angeles Raiders when they were in LA, and she had minor roles in Baywatch and was even a Playboy model. Now, she was nicknamed Delta Karen, and her last name is Cornwall, is a realtor in California, was an actor in the 90s going by the name of Patty Breton. She recently moved to Florida and was looking for a room for about $1,200 a month in the Florida Panhandle. But on her LinkedIn page, she describes herself as a luxury property specialist at Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, and specifically their California properties. Now, Cornwall, take a look, was seen hitting, scratching, and spitting at the older male passenger as the pair exchanged expletives after she approached him for not wearing his mask. She was arrested at the airport in Atlanta and is due to appear for initial appearance in the federal court. Ladies and gentlemen, you just can't make this stuff up. Now, let me know if you think that maybe Delta Karen may have been under the influence of alcohol or drugs, or perhaps a combination of both. Let me know in the comments below. Next on the docket, Ghislaine Maxwell. And as of the recording of this video, no verdict has been reached as of yet. But is the judge basically telling the jury to hurry things up? Well, the jury began their fifth day of deliberations today, on Tuesday, and Judge Allison Nathan extended deliberations to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, citing an astronomical spike in cases of the Omicron coronavirus variant, and it's time to have the jurors make plans to continue deliberating until a verdict is reached, which is exciting, ladies and gentlemen. Basically, they'll eventually get tired and they'll want to go home. Now, the judge noted that the surge of Omicron could force the jurors into quarantine and jeopardize their ability to complete the trial. So over roughly 24 hours of deliberation thus far, and jurors have submitted 8 notable questions to which the court together paint a somewhat of a discussion strand. Prosecutors have pushed back against the defense request for more instructions on count 2 and 4. Count 2 is for the enticement of a minor, charge regarding them to engage in travel as well as illegal acts. And count 4 is transporting a minor with the intent to engage in criminal activity, sexual activity, that is. Now, they carry a maximum sentence of 5 years and 10 years, respectively, and there's no reason to speculate what the jury is thinking. I mean, seriously, you can't ever know what a jury is thinking, particularly based upon the questions that they send to the judge. You just never know. The judge did say sending back the proposed additional instructions would just compound the problem. The judge noted the jurors have not asked any questions about count two, adding, quote, I'm not going to give them an incorrect instruction, end quote, which obviously that's the judge's job to do, is to provide all of the relevant and the correct jury instructions. And let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I have had cases where the jurors have asked a question and you think, oh, okay, that could go one way or other. And then the jury comes back and makes their decision rather quickly. My experience is usually when jurors do ask questions, not for supplies, but it's usually a clarification and usually to help somebody get that doubt out of their mind. Only once have I had a case where I was like, ooh, that's really a bad question. So my client was allegedly accused of threatening, well, let's just say judges and other people in positions of authority. And the first question was, does the defendant have access to our home addresses as well? Not a good question. Not a good question for the defense. It turned out to be not a good question indeed. So we just never know, but I assure you, this is the second worst part of the trial for the attorneys involved in both the prosecution and the defense. It's the waiting, thinking, what should I do? Because you really can't focus on anything else because you're so focused on waiting for the jury. It really is difficult. And you have to be within 5 minutes usually of the courthouse. The worst moment of any trial for any prosecutor or defense attorney, and particularly a defendant, is when attorneys are in fact notified and they say, we have a verdict. Every time I get that, literally my stomach sinks and I just get that nervous feeling in my stomach. You just never know what they're gonna do. All right, we'll let you know as soon as that verdict comes back. It's gonna be an interesting one for sure. All right, as I said, if we had a creep of the day, this guy would be the winner for creep of the year. A 31-year-old man stands accused of human trafficking after reportedly posing as a younger man with special needs, and he attempted to hire babysitters to change his diaper. Yeah. So in November of 2019, a human trafficking investigation was launched, leading to the ultimate arrest of Rutledge Dees IV. Now, Mr. Dees was allegedly posing as a younger man with special needs and would hire babysitters to change his diapers and treat him like a child. Now, in December of 2020, the police say that Mr. Dees pled guilty. Now, earlier this month, on December 20th, a second investigation was launched after detectives reportedly discovered a text Dees sent under similar circumstances. In the message, the police say that Mr. Dees offered to pay a victim to change his diapers and said he was undergoing alternative therapy. Now, according to the police, Mr. Dees posed as a younger man with these special needs again and tried to make the victim recruit another babysitter to take care of him as well. So on December 23rd, state police say Dees was arrested at his home and booked into the Jefferson Parish Correctional Center. He once again now faces human trafficking and attempted human trafficking charges. Ladies and gentlemen, I can't make this stuff up, okay? And everybody thinks, oh, Scott, this isn't real. This is just one-off type of stuff. This kind of stuff happens all the time, okay? And I'm telling you, this is the reason why you need to listen to this commercial and check out CrimeTalkSearch.com. Please go to CrimeTalkSearch.com, sign up for a background subscription service. You'll be happy you did. If there's anyone out there you were ever curious about what was in their background, now is the time to do it. If you're going to get involved with somebody, now is the time to do it. When you go to crimetalksearch.com, you put in the name, literally millions of public records are searched and a report is generated. And it's going to give you a report. If they have multiple social media accounts, you're going to find it. If they have multiple phone numbers, multiple email addresses, it's going to be found. And more importantly, you're going to get information regarding criminal history. Hopefully the person you're searching has none whatsoever. But if it's there, it's going to be found. You're going to get everything you'd want to know, whether you're going into business or whether you're going into a personal relationship. You're going to be able to find out the information you want to know. So go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up today. You'll be happy you did. And to continue on with the morbid show today, let's talk about the senseless violence in Florida. For a Florida real estate agent was shot multiple times while sitting in her car, and authorities say that her death may be related to an ongoing dispute between a tenant and a landlord. Sarah Michelle Trost, 40, drove last Thursday from her home in Parkland to a home in Coral Springs, Florida. She was sitting in her car in the driveway when she was ambushed and shot multiple times. Unfortunately, she passed away at the scene. Now, hours after the shooting, police arrested Raymond Wesley Reese of Boca Raton. He has been charged with murder in connection with Trost's death. Now, Reese was a tenant who has recently moved out of the home where Trost was shot. Trost did not own the home, but was at the property for business purposes. Now, Reese is being held appropriately without bond. He has not yet entered a plea at this time, and future court appearances were take place for an arraignment and preliminary hearing. And finally, our dumb criminal contestant of the day. As if most of our stories couldn't qualify as the dumb criminal of the day. That's right. We have the best one for the day. So Holly Alif walked into a shoe store in Prescott, Arizona, and asked employees to set aside several pairs of shoes for her because she was waiting for her husband to come and pay for the shoes. Seems reasonable. Haven't we all seen that take place? I think it's quite a common occurrence, like at Neiman Marcus, things like that. Well, Miss Alif came back about 40 minutes later, pointed a gun at two of the employees. She demanded money from both store registers and ordered both employees to carry the shoes that they had set aside to her car. And the employees placed the money and the shoes into the trunk, and she drove off. Now, the employees called the police and were able to provide a description of Miss Alif's vehicle, including her license plate. Now, officers found Alif's downtown with $3,700 in cash, $1,500 in shoes, and the gun that was used to point at the employees in the trunk. Now, police say Miss Alif admitted to her involvement and was booked into the jail on felony charges of armed robbery, aggravated assault, and kidnapping. Yes, Miss Alif, you are a dumb criminal contestant of the day. $1,500 in shoes, kidnapping, and aggravated robbery with the shoes and the money. Gonna go spend at least the next decade or two in custody. Are you kidding me? If you just had a job, you could have afforded the shoes. You wouldn't have to rob anybody. And you still have money left over. Because I assure you that $3,500, whatever you stole, you could have made a lot more over the next 10 years, 10, 20 years when you're going to be in custody. All right. Thanks for watching. Please join us this evening. Tonight is our Tuesday night live program. That's right, 6 p.m. Mountain Time after dark. And then we'll do our Patreon show immediately after that. Now, if you haven't joined the Patreon, you should do so. You can do it up until we start, actually. But please join us. And we, as always, we will take your calls. And that's right, we have the Magic 8 Ball as well. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.